Hello, everyone, and a warm welcome to our podcast series on carbon markets. My name is Adam Nye, and in this episode, we're talking about blue carbon. As a project activity in the nature-based removals segment of the voluntary carbon market, blue carbon has been the subject of much interest, as the restoration of coastal ecosystems has great potential for carbon sequestration, as well as being critical from a biodiversity standpoint. The Delta Blue Carbon Project has established itself as the key source of supply to this segment of the market, and at Argus, we recently commenced reporting on the wholesale market for its credits. To help me discuss all of this, I'm delighted to be joined by Nadeem Khan, the CEO and founder of Indus Delta Capital, and Chris Villiers from Respira. Nadeem and Chris, a warm welcome to you both, and thank you very much for joining me. So let's start with the most fundamental question. What is blue carbon?
So blue carbon refers to CO2 stored in coastal marine ecosystems. That's salt marshes, seagrasses, and of course, mangroves. These ecosystems are particularly efficient at absorbing CO2. And I think some of the data I've seen compared to sort of terrestrial forests, they're 10 times more efficient at sequestering CO2. And they also come with really significant biodiversity benefits and provide habitat for marine life. From a carbon project perspective, these can be kind of conservation activities, so conserving these areas. A lot of them have been degraded, and obviously it's kind of stopping that degradation and then maintaining and conserving what's remaining. Or they can be restoration, which is what's the case in the case of the Delta Blue Carbon Project, where you're actually replanting mangroves in that instance and restoring the ecosystems. There are methodologies under VERA and Gold Standard, but there aren't significant amount of projects yet that have reached kind of their full potential. I think I counted 18 projects on the VERA website. Some of them are relatively small, and I know there are lots in development, but you know it remains a relatively small segment of the market.
And if we think of blue carbon divided into mangroves, seagrass, and sea kelp, and my understanding is that they're effectively at different depths of the ocean in that order. In reality, is it correct that really when we talk about blue carbon in the context of carbon markets and projects, that it we're really talking about for the foreseeable future mangrove restoration and protection projects, seagrass and sea kelp is kind of at a different stage of development?
Yeah, I think that's right, exactly. So all of the projects that are at advanced stage are mangrove projects. I think there's lots of development going on, or development in terms of developing methodologies around seagrasses and kelp, but it'll be a little while before we see significant number of projects, approved projects in those areas.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Turning to Nadeem, how are blue carbon projects different to other project types?
The main differences of our terrestrial systems is the amount of carbon they sequester. But in our case, Indus Delta mangroves are sequestering sort of 5 to 6 times more carbon than a terrestrial system. And also what's unique about them is they tend to have a longer permanence than your terrestrial forest. So they lock away the carbon in the soil and it's buried there for centuries. So as the project progresses, you see the carbon in the soil gets more carbon rich. But I think what's a really other important point is the ecosystem services mangroves do provide as adaptation measures. So they protect against sea level rise, they stabilize the shoreline against erosion, and also act as a natural barrier to sort of flood surges and storm surges, which is very important in Pakistan because Pakistan, I guess, is amongst the top 10 countries that are affected by climate change right now. Yeah. And also the biodiversity benefits are quite unique. The root systems are very important. They provide important spawning grounds for fish and also sort of naturally filter the water. So there's sort of multiple benefits in terms of mitigation with the carbon and adaptation, protection against sea level rise, storm surges and floods.
Mm. Interesting. And on that point, Nadeem, about permanence, that's obviously a major issue with in particular forestry projects, you know, with the risks of forest fires and so on. And so I guess in a blue carbon context, in an ocean ecosystem, that fire is not a risk. Are there any kind of reversal events that typically might happen other than the original sources of degradation?
Generally, what we're finding is that the original sort of sources of degradation are the ones that need to be addressed. Ultimately, we're in an intertidal zone, so fire is not a risk, I guess. And the area where we're based is not geologically active. Mm-hmm. The only risk is storm surges and possibly tsunamis. But as we build the mangrove forest, then we build resilience to that. So it's built in sort of these measures in the project, I guess you could say.
Now, how about barriers to entry in this project type? That's something we've discussed and I believe is definitely an issue and perhaps, you know, one of the factors behind what Chris was mentioning, that on the supply side, you know, on the pipeline, there aren't really any extremely large or, you know, long pipeline of projects about to come to the market. So can we talk about what are the barriers to entry to blue carbon projects?
Okay, I think the barriers of entry is restoration of mangrove forests is quite an expensive business. Your cost of carbon can be quite high. It can be simply planting, which would be cheaper, but in some cases you'd have to change hydrology, which involved a lot of sort of earthworks. An entry sort of barrier is how much is it going to cost to restore and is restoration possible? Where the our project, the Delta Blue Carbon Project, is unique in the fact that we have scale. We're very fortunate in the fact that we have over 600,000 hectares of degraded delta. And I can't think of anywhere else in the world where you have that kind of intertidal space available to do a carbon project. Ultimately, there are coastlines and shorelines all around the world, but what we're doing is we're restoring an ecosystem. So our area, the whole 600,000 hectares, was initially a mangrove forest, which has been degraded over the years. So ultimately, the scale makes it sort of doable and in terms of like, it gives us the ability to raise money from the carbon markets to do it at scale. The other projects around the world tend to be smaller hectarage, so they'll struggle to sort of raise the financing because it's a very expensive business. Mm-hmm. Another barrier to entry is the methodologies available for greenhouse gas accounting. Ultimately, most methodologies out there look at terrestrial forests in general. The first mangrove methodology that we're using was developed in 2020. Those entry barriers are pretty strong. Setting a base case is pretty difficult as well. A lot of field work is involved. A lot of data is needed. We were lucky in Pakistan that we had over 30 years of sort of historical data sets in terms of mangrove growth. Mm-hmm. So a lot of work goes into sort of developing the baseline and then secondly, developing the technical documentation. And thirdly, then, you know, you realize, okay, you have enough carbon to make it worthwhile.
How about on the topic of adaptation finance? It's another element to blue carbon projects, isn't it, that they bring? And you know, is there that finance gap versus sequestration?
Sure, there's a huge sort of adaptation financing gap right now, and there's plenty of money in the voluntary markets for mitigation and conservation projects, but you don't find any adaptation measures. And this is what makes this project very unique in that we are protecting against sea level rise. We are protecting against coastal erosion, and we're protecting the communities against flooding. Recently, we had quite a few floods in Pakistan, in the Sindh province. Fortunately, our areas were less hit, so because the mangroves sort of provided a natural barrier. So in terms of non-tech solutions, mangrove forests are the best adaptation measures out there. And this kind of marries both mitigation and adaptation, as I said before. So the funding is going into sort of, you could say, mitigation and adaptation, which makes this project unique in that sense.
Yeah, so maybe just to focused on the project itself, Delta Blue Carbon. Perhaps we've touched on a few of the specific elements to it there. Can we just maybe give us a sense of the history behind it, how it came about, and I guess why it's been so successful?
Sure. So we started Industrial Capital in 2010. With the view that Pakistan had a huge deforestation problem, and at the time red was a big scene, and we thought, okay, look, Pakistan has these natural resources, so it should be tapping carbon markets to make things happen. So we started in 2010, and we started initially in the northern areas of Pakistan, looking at terrestrial forests, and we saw there was a deforestation problem. We thought red would be a good solution. And then what we did was we signed up with a number of provincial governments there and started arranging workshops. There was a huge sort of knowledge gap. So capacity building was needed at the federal and provincial levels. So we brought in experts from around the world to talk about carbon markets and to talk about carbon projects. And it's one of these sort of events that we first came across the work that the Sindh government had been doing in the Indus Delta. So the Indus Delta is a vast 600,000 hectare area on the coast of Sindh. And since the 1950s, the mangroves there have been degrading due to upstream activity. So there's a lot of huge dam projects in the northern part of Pakistan, which has stopped the supply of fresh water. And basically, since the 1950s, these lands had been abandoned. In the 1980s, the Sindh government first started sort of experimenting with small-scale restoration. And they built up specialism and knowledge over a period of sort of 20 years and reintroduced some extinct species as well. But all this was done on a very small scale and through grants. So we decided, you know, over sort of negotiations with them, that there's an opportunity here to actually tap the voluntary markets and do these activities at scale, which was important for us. And from day one, we thought, okay, look, we're going to do trade, not aid. We're not going to go for grants. We're not going to sell cheap. We're going to really invest into the area and start the project. So in 2013, we signed an MOU with the Sindh government, and the project actually kicked off in 2015. So it's been active now for 9 years. We've planted sort of 110,000 hectares of new mangroves. The plantations have been successful. We work with the local communities. There's 60 villages around the project area, 42,000 people. So we have community buy-in, we have complete government buy-in, and us as the private sector working together. So it works really well, and every partner is just as important as the others. We rely on the communities as the ultimate stewards of these mangrove forests. It's a long project, it's a 60-year project, so it's going to be there for some time. So we need to sort of instill into the community that these forests are worth more standing than cut. And slowly but surely, as 10, 11 years have progressed, we're getting to that stage now.
On that topic, the co-benefits of the project and the sustainable development goals that it meets, can you kind of bring to life a little bit in the ways that it is embedded with those communities that you mentioned? What are some of those things mean in real world terms?
Okay, so the project that we do covers 14 SDGs. It kind of goes back to the design of the project. So the project was designed in partnership with the communities, where we sat down and we said, what are the main causes of the degradation and what can we do about it? And what do you guys need to sort of act as stewards to these plantations? So ultimately it came down to that we need to provide extra sources of income for the communities and lower their living costs. So a lot of these communities sort of live in sort of remote areas, so they don't have a quick access to medical facilities, they don't have quick access to education facilities, and these are something that we provide them. So we've given them ambulances, we've set up local health centers, we have regular meetings where we go to them and talk about hygiene, sanitation, we've done vaccination drives throughout there. So Industrial Capital has a community outreach team which works very closely with these communities. A lot of them were actually fishermen, and they were, in the past, they were doing unsustainable practices. So as the feedback we got from them, as the years went by, the fish catch became smaller and smaller. So we work with them, we give them, we've taken away a lot of their illegal gill nets, given them proper nets, and told them sort of we need to fish in a sustainable way. So they work with us and the fisheries department, and we're planning sort of two sort of marine protected zones as well. So in terms of what happens there is that we pay the fishermen to protect the area and not to fish. And generally what this helps overall with the fish catch, up until now it had been totally unsustainable. And the last 2 years we've been had sort of feedback from the fishermen. They're seeing improved catch, they're seeing bigger fish as well, which is great. So that, I guess, feeds into sort of life below water, no poverty, no hunger, lines up with those SDGs. Also, what we do is we employ community members to do all our planting work. So since the project's inception, we've employed 8,000 people from the communities to do the planting. And once the planting is done, then we pay families and community members to act as mangrove stewards. So we'll take a 110 hectare area, give it to a particular family, give it to a particular village to make sure that the mangroves grow successfully. And if there's any problems, they give us feedback. So what we're really trying to do is sort of create a sort of green economy where the communities are paid to plant, to look after the mangroves as stewards longer term, because this has to be a generational thing. It can't be just for 10 years. And in return, we try increase their incomes and reduce their living costs through measures like access to the healthcare, access to better education, access to clean water as well. There's a number of reverse osmosis plants that we're putting in strategic locations. So a lot of these people have to travel a long way to get their water. So it's available locally. So we're just working with them. And obviously, we get continual feedback. We've arranged all the 42 villages into village development committees. We meet them on a regular basis just to keep track of how our intervention's doing and what we could be doing differently. So it's an evolving process over time, but it seems to be working very well. And the feedback we have from the community is excellent. And I think the success of the project sort of demonstrates the full community buy-in, because without the community buy-in, then these projects wouldn't be successful.
Can I chip in slightly? Because
please do.
I think Nadim is almost being a bit modest with the description of the sort of community involvement. I mean, I was lucky enough to visit the site last year, and you know, apart from being sort of struck by the vast size of it and the you know the planting that was being done, it was really how it was clear that this project has kind of just breathed life into these communities that you know, in a very rural location. Who are simply reliant on pretty sort of subsistence fishing. And this has given them kind of new opportunities. Nadim mentioned there the healthy education, water sanitation, but actually it's also, you know, it's livelihoods as well. And it's they are part of the project. Going around the mangroves, we're seeing families going out and collecting proper gills, so seeds effectively, that they can then delivered to the project and get paid for. It's an alternative source of income. Obviously, Nadim's mentioned the stewardship plan there, and then you know significant involvement in the planting. So there's diversified the local economy enormously through the one project.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, that's maybe a good moment to focus a little bit more on Respira, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what their involvement has been in the project.
Sure. So our involvement has been a little more recent than Nadim's. We were introduced to Nadim actually by Pollination, who's a shareholder in the project, in 2021. And you know, we're providing a route to monetize some of the credits. And you know, the kind of the proposition that we have for, well, not just this project, but other projects as well, is to provide a multi-year offtake, which provides the project developer with a floor price, so a minimum price for the credits that they issue and then deliver to Respira.
Mm-hmm.
Respira is obviously not an end user of the credits, so they will then sell on to any number of their corporate clients. And to the extent that they make any profit or gross margin above the floor price, Respira will share that margin with the project developer, so Interstealth Capital in this case, so that over the long term the contract remains equitable. There's a kind of fair share to the project developer, and you know, to the extent that there is a big uplift in the market, then the project and the associated communities are benefiting from the uplift in the market, which we think is very important in this market. So the project's now issued once, and we have, you know, monetized those credits, and we've sold them on, and we've made those rebates back to Interstellar Capital.
Great, thanks, Chris. And now, I guess, focusing a little bit more now on that commercial side, what are some of the typical structures and routes to market that you use to sell those credits to the market?
The Delta Blue project, we felt it would be a good idea to do an auction, because it was the first substantial issuance of a blue carbon project. And the auction, public auction that we did with CIX, was provided a useful benchmark, pricing benchmark to the market. We thought that was a good approach, given it was sort of the first substantial issuance of those credits in the market, and was able to give a bit of price transparency. And obviously, you know, we found that there is significant demand for blue carbon credits in particular, and obviously those from this project in particular. And so they commanded a high price relative to other nature-based carbon projects. So that's one route that we have to market. We have, you know, a number of corporate clients, and we sell to them or sort of bilaterally. So they are purchasing carbon credits as part of their decarbonization pathways. And, you know, we're looking to enter into either sales for just spot credits, but also we're looking to do longer term sales to them as well, so that they can have a kind of a regular supply of carbon from this project in particular, and can get some sort of association with the project, which is typically what corporates are looking to do. We think we're adding a bit of extra reach on the commercial side for the project, ensuring that they're able to, you know, we're able to supply those out through the market, and in particular directly to corporate end buyers.
What do you think is the appeal? You know, blue carbon has, you know, has become it's a corner of the market that's attracted a lot of interest. Obviously, they price at a premium to almost every other part of the actively traded voluntary carbon market, if you want to put it like that. Where does it fit? What buyers are looking for? Is it just all of those things that we've discussed? You know, is it the removals? Very high quality project all round, but you know, high co-benefits and SDGs. Is there anything particular about it? Is it just a combination of all of those factors that really make it of such great interest to buyers?
Yeah, I think it is a combination, exactly as you say. Obviously, critical that it is it's a removals project, so it's sequestering. It's not avoiding carbon emissions. It's actually sequestering carbon. It's relatively clear and easy to measure. There's sort of simplicity in that, you know, which obviously is sort of brings comfort around the carbon integrity. And the co-benefits are very clear, both from a biodiversity perspective, helping, you know, improving fish yields even in the Delta, but the co-benefits to the communities are very direct and very clear. So I think it's a combination of all those factors.
Great. Well, thanks to you both. Maybe just this time for a couple of last thoughts about maybe what the future, the near future holds at least. Nadine, what's coming up over the next 12 months or so for the project?
Yeah, Adam. So for the next 12 months, we continue to sort of scale up our planting activities. We're planning 35,000 hectares for next year, and we've just sort of launched the second phase of the project, which is a further 250,000 hectares of the Delta. So we'll be very busy sort of planting for the next 8 to 9 years, then we'll complete our planting. Another thing we're looking at is the use of technology to help in the monitoring and sort of increase the integrity of our project. So we're investing in LiDAR and remote sensing technology, and just comparing that to sort of traditional methods and see if there's any differences or inaccuracies in terms of biomass measurement, which is very important in this industry. You're completely judged on that. So hopefully we'll be collecting a lot of data sets there and building a sort of a digital model of our forest, which ultimately we'd like to share with our buyers, have it buyer-facing. And I think some of the technologies that we'll employ will be useful for the wider blue carbon market and hopefully help bring down costs for project developers throughout the world. And in that way, we may see more projects sort of kicking off in the region sort of globally. We're interested in sort of promoting our project, but in the wider context, we're looking at sort of really pushing blue carbon and making it easier for everyone to sort of enter into doing a blue carbon project.
Thanks, Nadim. Chris, what about the outlook a little bit for the market?
Yeah, well, I think we're expecting blue carbon projects, in particular the removals, blue carbon, the restoration projects such as Delta Blue, to continue to command a premium in the market, and we continue to see strong demand for the project, and supply is probably going to continue to be relatively constrained. We've heard Nadim started this in, what was that, 2012?
2013, yeah.
Sorry, 2013. It takes an awful long time to develop these projects. It is painstaking work. And I know there are lots in the pipeline, but it's going to be a while before we've got lots of other issued carbon credits from blue carbon restoration. So I think, we expect that strong pricing to continue. And we think, as there's more visibility, I mean, Nadine's talking about the MRV side there, that gives more kind of transparency. If we think that's only going to reinforce the premium and the demand that there will be for this project and projects like it.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Nadim and Chris, for joining me to discuss that. Thank you to everyone also for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye.